$1 cash prize donated from the Bayview chapter.
It's on.
And the winner is Donna Sanchez. Are you in the room? All right, Donna. Donna is here. Okay. We are going to do two banquet tickets for tonight. The banquet. And we're doing two in one prize. So, and Ed is having Roger pick the name. Two banquet tickets and a bag of this wonderful fudge. One delicious, and it's homemade fudge. Elizabeth McFadden, are you in the room? She is not. Bernice said, Roger, do better. Peter Pardini. Now, Peter is down in exhibits. And I know that Peter already has a banquet ticket. So let's go ahead and draw another. Peter has lots of friends. He's our treasurer. I'll share some of my fudge with him. Okay, we're picking another name. Linda O'Neill, are you in the room? Okay. Linda, yeah, the prize is two banquet tickets and a bag of fudge. So, Is there a friend that you'd like to invite to come with you, or would you just prefer to take the one and then we'll... Okay, you're very welcome. Okay, I am going to... first, before I give the microphone over to our presiding officer, I want... Oh, and that's not the presiding officer. I promise you. You're going to say, oh, no, let me out. Before I give the microphone over to our presiding officer, I want each and every one of you to join me in a rousing thank you to our silver sponsor, Vanda Pharmaceuticals Incorporated. Now I know that folks have said they wanted to go visit them in the exhibit hall, and there was no one at their table because the third person who was supposed to come with them was not able to. But you saw in the program that we had a small focus group because Vanda was very interested in meeting with people who did not qualify for the sleep study. So what I would encourage you to do, because I hear some people were surprised about that, I encourage you to listen to the California Connection on a weekly basis. Thank you. I heard a yay back there. That was Pampology. I know that. I'd encourage you to listen to the California Connection on a weekly basis. Either via telephone or on the website. Get on the listserv to receive the connection, because I did put that in the connection and on the listservs because I didn't want anyone to be left out, whether they use a computer or not. And so I put that out there. They are interested. We had the first focus, small focus group here, because they do want to hear from people who didn't qualify. So this was the start. And I will keep you informed through the connection, when, you know, and if the possibility happens where they want to do more groups like that with people who didn't qualify. Because I heard from a number of you who said, you know, I was very discouraged. I didn't qualify. And they heard that. And this convention, their sponsorship and the small focus group was a result of hearing that many of you were interested. So again, one more round of applause for Vanda Pharmaceuticals, our silver sponsor. Thank you. Who seeks the floor? What I'd like, thank you, Pam. What Pam reminded me of is in the room here last night, someone left a note-taking device. And it was in its case, and so if anyone is missing something, it is at the Hotel Lost and Found. So I'd encourage you to go and touch base if you left a piece of technology in the room last night that you are missing. Thank you very much for that reminder, Pam. Yes. On that note, I would like to give the... Oh, Roger's hunting for it. Okay, here comes Ed. I'd like to have everyone give a big hand for today's presiding officer, Roger Peterson.
Oh, thank you. Okay, to begin the, by the way, there was something I was going to say about the door prizes. I remember that hearing sometime that ago that TIP, the term TIP, was an acronym that was to ensure promptness. So I think these door prizes we give at the very beginning of the session are TIP door prizes. The first thing we're going to do this afternoon is to have the presentation of the colors. And this is going to be done by a color guard from three Girl Scout troops in the San Diego area, directed by Minerva Kellis. And they're actually going to make some noise, so you will hear them. And they tell us that they're going to tell us when to rise and when to be seen. So, color guard, if you will, please.
Attention, color guard. Attention, color guard. Mark time. Hut. Color guard, advance. Color guard, halt. Color guard, present colors. Color guard, honor your colors. Please stand for the Pledge of Allegiance. Ready, begin. I pledge allegiance to the flag of the United States of America and to the Republic for which it stands, one nation, under God, indivisible, for liberty and justice for all. Please be seated. Color guard, attention. Mark time, hut. Color guard, advance. Color guard, halt. Color guard, dismissed.
That's what I like, a color guard that makes some noise. What happened to my, okay, there we go. That's what I like, a color guard that makes some noise so that we blind folks can tell what they're doing. I did ask the leader if she had any cookies, and she said no. But I tried, you know. Okay, so the first program speaker is a topic. I always seem to get to preside over the history stuff. We have Gabe Selak, who is the public programs manager of the San Diego History Center. And he tells me he started out as a monorail driver, and he moved up through the ranks. He's going to talk to us about the history of the area and of Del Mar in particular. So I'm looking forward to hearing about that. So can we welcome Gabe Selak?
Thank you, everyone. It's my pleasure to come out and talk to you today a little bit about our region's history. Just a real quick show of hands, how many people are actually from Southern California? Lots of you are. All right. I just wanted to get a sense of where you may have come from, because I'm actually not originally from California or from San Diego. I came from Pennsylvania, and then I moved to Boston for a few years before I moved out here. But I come from San Diego History Center. We are a repository for the history of our region, and our collection encompasses a tremendous amount of material dedicated to our past here. Some of that information I'm going to share with you today. Let me just tell you a little bit about the History Center and chance you have an opportunity to go there. We are located in Balboa Park, and we are located in a building called the Casa de Balboa. It is the same building that houses the Model Railroad Museum and the Museum of Photographic Arts. So if you're looking for us, that's where you'll find us, in Balboa Park. Our collection, though, encompasses 2.5 million photographs. It's one of the largest photograph collections west of the Mississippi. And it encompasses whenever San Diego County included other counties around us, like Imperial County and places like that. We have a document collection, like marriage records and court records and deeds and scrapbooks and all sorts of ephemera, things that were created for special events around the community. Our document collection is about 45 million sheets of paper. Yeah, and if we were to line everything side by side, it's about 4 miles of documents. So it's a tremendous amount of paper that we have in our holdings. We also have an object collection, household items and things that have been used by people in San Diego over the years. Some large-scale objects that we have at the History Center include a Model T Ford that was came to San Diego in 1921. It still has its original paint job. Yeah, it's amazing. The woman who owned it, her name was Florence Newkirk, and she was a Olympic swimmer, and she won a gold medal in 1924 in the Olympics. But her parents, they bought her this car, and she drove it around for a little while, but after a time she decided that she wanted to keep it in good condition, and so she put it into a barn in their property in East County. And it basically, it would only come out for parades and things, but all the rest of the time it was stored in this barn. So it's in impeccable condition, and as I mentioned, has its original paint job. We also have a streetcar that used to run up and down one of our major streets in San Diego, Park Boulevard, and that is inside of our building. When they built our building, they actually had to put it inside with a crane to get it inside of the building. But lots and lots of objects that just tell you the history of our community and treasured possessions that people have had that they think, and we agree, tell a wonderful side of San Diego's past. But let me ask you this. If you would have come here in, let me reform the question. San Diego was actually established or first discovered in 1542 by a gentleman named Juan Rodriguez Cabrillo. And when he came here, he named this place something completely different than it is today. Anybody have an idea of what our city would be called if we would have kept the name that he gave us? Yes, I see over there to the left. That's right, San Miguel. We would have all be living in or traveling to the city of San Miguel. Usually the Spanish, as they would come to different ports, they would name the port closest to the saint's day of their arrival. They'd have a mass and that sort of thing. And when Cabrillo arrived in 1542, it was around the feast of San Miguel, or Saint Michael, or San Miguel. So it was originally written down that our port would be San Miguel. Took about 70 years or more, maybe I'm not so good with math, but in 1602, Sebastian Vizcaino comes here to San Diego, and at the time that he arrived, it was around the feast of St. Didacus, or San Diego, and so the name was changed to San Diego, and it's been that way ever since. As for people living here in the region, native people have been here for thousands and thousands of years, long before the Europeans arrived. In fact, just a little bit to the east of here is a town called Rancho Santa Fe. And through archaeological evidence and digs that have been done in that particular location, they found that that is the first site that the native people settled in when they came across the land bridge, you know, the Bering Strait and things, and wandered their way down here. Rancho Santa Fe is the first place that they settled, and that was over 20,000 years ago. The more recent people are the San Diego or San Dieguito people, and they would have arrived here around 1,000 years ago. So native people have been in the region for thousands and thousands of years. The Europeans, of course, Juan Rodriguez Cabrillo and then Vizcaino, but the first families to live in the region started after the Sacred Expedition, which would have been Father Junipero Serra, you've probably heard that name around town, and Gaspar de Portola. Father Serra was responsible for converting all of the natives to Christianity and to setting up a series of missions. He would ultimately set up 9 of 21 missions here in Southern or Alta California. And alongside of him, they were setting up military outposts, and that's where Portola was responsible for. So he set up the fort, and then Father Serra took care of the religious orders. And that would have started in 1769. Now, San Diego has had many, many different changes. Lots of different cultures have laid claim to this particular region. Of course, the native people first, then we have the Spaniards, then we have the Mexican period, which would be in the 1820s through the 1840s. And during that time, San Diego really developed its first major industry. And that was the hide and tallow trade. So we had all these cows that were brought to the region when the Spaniards arrived here to work on the missions and things. But after Mexico declared independence from Spain, there wasn't a need for having those missions properties any longer. So the Mexican officials decided to divide out the land to give it to different householders. And that began our rancho period here in San Diego. Many of the places that are still place names today, cities that we have today, were formed during that ranch period. Places like Rancho Panasquitas, Rancho Bernardo, Rancho Jojome, Santa Margarita de la Flores, which is now Camp Pendleton, all of these places were once former mission lands that were converted to Mexican territory during the Mexican period. Now, the war of this Mexican-American War that happens in 1846, major battle is going to happen here in San Diego County. Anybody know what that battle is? Yeah.
San Pascual.
That's right, the Battle of San Pascual. Interesting story about that. So Stephen Kearney, who was the military officer responsible for the American forces, he was coming here from New Mexico. He was told by Robert Stockton, who was sort of the commander of San Diego at the time, he was told to come through San Pascual Valley and to do it rather secretively because they knew that the Mexican officials were around, and in particular, Andreas Pico, who was the leader of the Californios, and also Andreas Pico was Pio Pico's brother. Pio Pico is the last Mexican governor to rule over this territory. But Kearney was told to be very secretive about coming through because he didn't want to sort of get in any sort of battle on his way to San Diego. Well, he's journeying out and hears that there are these Californios in the valley, and he wants to know just how many people are actually there. So he sends a man named Gillespie, and there's an airfield named Gillespie Airfield around town named after him. He sent Gillespie out to go and count these Californios. But Kearney told Gillespie, be very, very quiet. Don't make any noise. We don't need any battles or anything like that. So Archibald Gillespie goes out. He's very curious about what's going on. Just so happens, as they get close to the Californios, someone in his group rattles a saber. And so that wakes all the Californios up. Archibald Gillespie runs back to Kearney and says, oops, I made a little noise. And so Kearney at that point had no choice but to continue onward and push through the Californios. There was a major battle. It happened in December of 1846. And as a military battle for the United States, we actually really lost the battle. We lost about 20 men in that battle, whereas the Californios lost 6. So from a military standpoint, we really lost. Robert Stockton, who was in Old Town at the time, he was at a fandango at the Bandini's house. He was at a big party. And he gets word from Kearney that he's having this trouble in San Pascual Valley. And so he sends someone to talk to Commodore Stockton. And he's like, okay, I'll send somebody. So he eventually sends some forces, and it puts the end to the battle. But it really is a major player in the Mexican-American War. Happened right here in San Diego. And from that point then, the United States took over this particular territory. And our downtown changed a lot. There's a gentleman who is the father of downtown San Diego. His name is Alonzo Horton. Get this, how much land he was able to buy for such a cheap price. To create our downtown, he bought 970 acres of land for 27 cents an acre. Yeah. Can you imagine how cheap? I mean, people were, he saw the vision of what our future could be here in San Diego, and he really wanted to have a major metropolis here, which we've turned out to be. We're the 8th largest city in the United States. But he saw the potential of that, and this is before the railroad actually got to San Diego. And I will get to the Del Mar story in just a minute, in case you're wondering where that fits into this. But Horton purchases 970 acres. He starts to build downtown, and then the train, ultimately, there is a main direct train route to San Diego that is created, and the terminus of it will be at National City. At that point, people start to flood here to San Diego, and that's going to happen in 1885. Previous to that, all of our population in San Diego consisted of less than 3,000 people. Once we received a direct train route from the east, our population from 1885 to 1887 shot to 40,000 people. Yeah. The cost, now this is amazing to me too, the cost to get from Chicago to San Diego, first you would have to go to San Francisco because there was no direct train route in the 1870s. So you would take a train to San Francisco, and that would cost you $125. And then from there, you would take a sidewheeler, a paddle boat, which would bring you from San Francisco. Most people took the Orizaba. That's the name of the boat. It's kind of like the Mayflower of the West. You know, it really brought a lot of settlers here to San Diego. But the Orizaba brought people here, or the Senator. That was the other ship that brought a lot of people here. But it was $125 to get to San Diego in the 1870s. When the train finally arrives here, the price drops to $1. Yeah, so that's going to increase all of these people flooding out here. And the other thing that is being promoted at this time is, and the train companies are really using this to their advantage, they are promoting San Diego as the most healthy place in the country. Some of the advertisements that we have in our ephemera collection at the History Center say that directly. They say, doctors will find no employment here. That it's just such a wonderful place to come and live. And so people are going to take that advice, and they're going to move out here. In places like Carlsbad, which is not very far from here, it's going to be set up as a sanitarium for people to come and drink the mineral water and get healthy. The Hotel Del Coronado, which is out on Coronado, another sanitarium. People are going to go there to get healthy. Rest Haven. There's lots and lots of, I could go on for days about all these different preventatoriums and sanatoriums that were created for people who were living in the West or in the East that had consumption, or better known as tuberculosis. And the best thing for you to do when you have that those conditions is to get dry air. And of course, we have that here in San Diego. So people were coming out here in droves. And that's really how Del Mar got started, too. When the railroad finally came to San Diego, we first had it from, it came up from Yuma, Arizona, and across the southern route. Eventually, there was a route that was brought down from San Francisco. Oh, I should mention this to you, too. You know, we're always, as we're driving to Los Angeles or something, it's like 2 hours to get there, right? And everybody's like, oh my gosh, it takes forever to get there. In the time before the train arrived, it would take you 2 days to get to Los Angeles from here. Yeah, 2 days. By a stagecoach, it would take you 2 days. To get to San Francisco, it would take you 2 weeks. What's it take to drive there today? 7 hours. Yeah. So we've made some improvements, definitely, in our transportation getting here. Also, depending on how much you purchased or what level of passage you purchased on your stagecoach would also determine how comfortable your trip was. If you paid first-class passage, you got to stay inside the stagecoach no matter what happens, right? If you pay second-class passage, you are asked to get out and walk alongside of the stagecoach if there's any trouble. Yeah, what do you suppose happens if you pay third-class passage? You have to get out and push. Yep, that's your job. So people are going to be striving, I think, to get that first-class passage as much as possible. But when the train arrives here, of course, it's going to change everything. And it's really going to help to develop Del Mar as well. There's a gentleman, his name was Loop, Theodore Loop. He was one of the investors in the Southern California Railroad, which was coming down from Los Angeles. And as he came past this area over and over again, he realized it was, and even quotes it as being the most beautiful place in Southern California. So he decides to purchase 330 acres from a neighbor of his. His name is Enoch Talbert. He purchases 330 acres for $1,000. And he sets up a little tent city, because that's really how a lot of our communities got started. Before hotels were built and houses were shipped around the Horn to come to San Diego and to Del Mar and places, people lived in tents for months at a time. But he decided to create a community here, and his wife was asked to name the town. And her name was Ella Loop, and she was reading a poem at the time that they were here. It was The Fight on Paseo del Mar. That's the name of the poem. It was a popular poem at that time. And she loved it so much that she chose Del Mar as the name of this community. So Loop and another gentleman a short time after, his name is Colonel Taylor. He was really quite prominent in developing towns. And he really, Taylor in particular, saw Del Mar as a place for the rich and famous to come. And so he decided to hire another town planner who mostly worked in East County. His name is Ed Fletcher. There's a parkway in the Fletcher Parkway named after Edward Fletcher. Edward Fletcher is also responsible for developing Grossmont, if you are familiar with that area. So Ed Fletcher and Taylor, they get together and they start to plan what Del Mar will look like. And it's very, very important that they attract the wealthy and they attract the rich and famous of Los Angeles and things, and also in the East. And so they decided that they are going to build a train station here in Del Mar, a very attractive train station. They're going to build a pier that goes and has a bathing pool that's out in the ocean, but it's enclosed. Because a lot of people didn't know very well how to swim in the 1880s and 90s. In fact, if you ever have a chance to see pictures of the people going out and swimming at this time, there's ropes out in the water so that people could hold on to them because their clothing weighed so much. Their clothing was made of wool. And so, you know, if you're not a very good swimmer and you go out into the ocean in a wool costume, you can imagine you're going to sink pretty quickly. And so they have these ropes that go out into the ocean. But they decided to build an actual wading pool inside of the ocean, but it was an enclosed space. Because this time, too, the 1880s is a time of change for people. They are loosening the restrictions of the Victorian era. Previous to this, it would be really unlikely for men and women to be seen bathing on the beach together. just something that wouldn't have happened. There'd be men's sections and women's sections. But in the 1880s, there's a whole change of philosophy that the sea air is good, sea water is good for you, so you should spend as much time as you can. And why separate yourselves but socialize out together? And people who are sort of old standards who lived during the time when it was men and women separated from each other, they were really quite shocked by that. And so the hotels that were built in this area, and one in particular, here in Del Mar, it was the Casa Del Mar, later replaced by the Stratford Inn, which is in downtown Del Mar today. They had in their bathrooms, they had tubs that allowed for you to pour hot water, cold water, or seawater into your bathtub. So if you were, you couldn't fathom going out and being on the beach if you're a man and being on the beach with women or vice versa, you could still have that sea bath experience. But you do it in the privacy of your own bathroom at your hotel. And the Hotel Del Coronado was set up the same way. It had 400 rooms, 70 bathrooms, so you still had to share a bathroom with lots of different people. But it had hot water, cold water, and seawater so that you could have a private bath if you wanted. Now, I mentioned that they decided to build the hotel. The first one, the Casa Del Mar, it burned down, later replaced by the Stratford Inn that is there today. But once that was created, then they were able to add a plunge, which was a very popular pastime in the 1900s, to allow people to either go into the ocean if they wanted to or could still have a freshwater experience as well. So really, that's how Del Mar gets started. What we're probably mostly knowing about Del Mar today is the horse races and things like that. Everybody's familiar with where the surf meets the turf, right? Anybody know who came up with that slogan? Bing Crosby, exactly. Yeah, we'll talk about him in just a minute. Really how the whole concept of the Del Mar racetrack started a little bit before that. In the 1880s, it was decided that California would start to have agricultural fairs. And the first one that was held in this region was in National City. It was the horticulture and agricultural display that was in 1880, and it was in National City. And after that, these sort of agricultural fairs were kept in different locations around the county. There, for a time, were in Escondido. There were some that were in downtown San Diego. Even Balboa Park, for a while, was the host of an agricultural state fair. But it was decided in the 1930s that we needed to have a permanent location in our county for a state fair, an agricultural fair. Now, there weren't an awful lot of animals, so it was primarily fruits and vegetables, as we are very well known here for our agriculture. So it was decided to purchase a property. It was the old Del Mar Golf Course. It was purchased to become the headquarters or the home of the Del Mar Fair. And the first Del Mar Fair was held in October of, I'm losing the date, I'm sorry. It's in the 1930s that was finally here in Del Mar. But over a very short amount of time, less and less people were coming just to see the agricultural exhibits. And fortunately, when they built the Del Mar Fairgrounds, they did build an oval track. And they thought the best way to increase people coming to the fair would be start to have horse races. And so they decided to develop a grandstand, and they looked for people in the region who could help promote it. And one of the people who was really interested in it was Bing Crosby. He was already very heavily invested in horse racing in other parts of our region, in particular Agua Caliente, which was a major racetrack in Tijuana. He was very, very instrumental in the development of that and thought that Del Mar could do just as well. And so he personally invested in it, and two other gentlemen were the creators of the Del Mar racetrack. And in 1937, they opened the first races here. So that was in July of 1937. Now, Bing Crosby wanted all the rich and famous of Hollywood to come here too, and so he would have special occasions for people to meet various celebrities. People like the Lucille Ball and Desi Arnaz were seen there quite often. And this continued, you know, famous people have continued to come here. Angie Dickinson used to frequent here a lot. Paul Bacharach, is that how you say his? Yeah, he used to come here quite often too. So lots and lots of famous people have come. Bing Crosby, when they opened in July of 1937, he wanted everybody to see that he was heavily invested in the project and making sure it was a success, that he stood at the entrance gate and he greeted every single person that came in. Yep. And he did that for several years. He would be sure to be there at opening day. Now, there's another tradition that is part of opening day ceremonies. It's very, very popular custom, and that is the hats, right? Sally Tibbett, who she was a philanthropist here in town. She and her husband very instrumental in helping a lot of different causes. But she would always attend opening day, and she thought that, yeah, it was great, you know, fun thing to go and watch the horses and that. But she wanted it to be people to come in their best attire. And so she started to wear very elaborate hats to the opening day ceremonies. And eventually, other people really started to pay attention to what she was wearing. And they started to model after her and started to bring their own fashionable hats. And eventually, by 1958, it became a really, really popular custom for people to start wearing very unique and unusual hats. And that tradition continues today. So we have lots and lots of, lots of milliners in the region do quite well for themselves as a result of having the hats. We have... The racetrack gets started after the fairgrounds gets completed, but then World War I hits, World War II in the 1940s comes along, and during that time, the Del Mar Fair as well as the racetrack are shut down for a number of years, and the entire complex and the whole region of Del Mar and even La Jolla and things, it becomes a major military operation. There are several camps that are set up here, military training facilities, Camp Callan, we have Camp Matthews, and Camp Callan in particular was an anti-aircraft gunnery that was located just off of where the UCSD campus is today. So the military really took over this region, and it continued that way up until the time that the war ended. Del Mar has continued its focus on education, and that would come about in the 1960s with the UCSD campus, and it continues even into everyday life too. Del Mar is quite well known for its literary circle today, so lots of writers, lots of artists, lots of... literary associations and people who are reading books to know, manuscripts for future books and things, that all happens in this area too. So on the cultural forefront, on the entertainment and sporting forefront with the racetrack, and of course still continuing our tradition of agriculture with the fair every year as well. So that's a short story of Del Mar and our region. Anybody have any questions? I'll give a few minutes for you to, if you have any questions. Yes, in the back.
Hi, I decided to go ahead and attend this part of this general session on San Diego history because I'm always learning something about San Diego.
Great.
Can you tell me a little bit about the street that runs along the rail, the racetrack, and how Via de la Valle got its name?
I'm sorry, I really don't know the answer to that. I'm sorry.
One more?
Yes, does Del Mar adjoin La Jolla, and how far from us is the UC San Diego campus?
Del Mar is connected to La Jolla, and from
here to get to UCSD. It's about a 10-minute drive. So it's south of here, south and east of here is the UCSD campus. Mm-hmm. Oh, we've got some questions here in the front.
You probably already know this, but on occasion the Del Mar advertisements would play a short clip from a record that Bing Crosby recorded, mm-hmm. Old Del Mar. Do you have that in your collection, I hope?
We do, yes. And thank you for mentioning that. In addition to ephemera, so like leaflets and pamphlets and things that are created for various occasions, we also have music clips. We have an extensive oral history project at the History Center. Started as early as the 1880s. People were writing down and getting people's memories while they were still living here and still alive. We do have music clips, and we have musical instruments as well as part of our collection. We have the sheet music and things too, so yes. Mm-hmm. I think we're just about out of time. So thank you, everyone. It's been my pleasure to come in and talk to you today. Thank you.
Hello. I think I'm being heard, maybe. This hearing device, it's sometimes hard to tell a little bit. Thank you very much, Mr. Selek, and that was very interesting, and we could go on for a while. I noticed, by the way, that we're on El Camino Real here.
Yes.
And I live a block off El Camino Real in Mountain View up beyond San Jose. So I figured maybe I could just get on the 22 bus up there on El Camino Real and head on down here, but apparently not to be. But I gather that it was all originally the King's Highway that went all the way up. Again, thank you for that. We like our history here, especially us old guys. Our next presenter is from the Transportation Security Administration, and connected with the San Diego Airport. Now we had Michael Aguilar. We now have Paul Leonard. And so I don't know what his title is at the TSA the TSA facilities at the airport, but I'm sure he can tell us. And we're looking forward to this because we are fascinated by the rituals that we get put through as we go to fly, as we came down here and so on. So, Mr. Leonard, tell us about transportation security. Do you want to use this mic, or do you have a mic?
Are these working? It's on. Good afternoon, everybody. My name is Paul Leonard. I'm the Assistant Federal Security Director for Screening Operations at San Diego International Airport. It's really a pleasure to be here to speak with you today, and I'll apologize for if anybody's disappointed that General Aguilar is not here to speak with you. I know he hasn't passed. General Aguilar has taken advantage of his long and very significant history in federal service, both in the Marine Corps and after 10 years with TSA, and decided to retire. Lucky him. So that's a great thing for him. So you're stuck with me, and I'll do my best to make this informative and interesting. And again, thank you very much for inviting us to speak today. So I mentioned I'm the Assistant Federal Security Director for Screening Operations. I'm responsible really for everything that happens at the airport in terms of screening passengers and persons. And I know that's a very significant issue for all of you, both from a security standpoint and staying safe, and also because the airport's a daunting place. I've spent really my entire career in the airport, first with the airlines for 25 years. I was with a great little San Diego-based airline known as TSA or PSA. Woo-hoo! I know. See, I love you guys already. Oh, yes. And so, you know, it was a great little airline, so I was here for a while and then continued on with U.S. Airways when they bought PSA. So we're very much connected to the San Diego area. And as I was saying, the airport's a daunting place. In the airline business, we worked really hard to make the experience as trouble-free as possible, especially went to great lengths for those that have special needs and disabilities. And so I'm really here to both continue that and to help make the part of that experience that's now the security checkpoint perhaps a little bit more understandable. So I want to talk a little bit about TSA, about our mission, about what we've been doing the past 10 years and where we're going. I think that's significant. And then I'll talk a little bit about the procedures, especially those for passengers with disabilities and the blind and visual impairments. And like I said, hopefully we'll be able to demystify some of that. And since you know who I am now, you know that when we come through San Diego and there are challenges and we're not doing it the way we should, you know who to talk to, and I'm certainly going to be there for you. Okay, so San Diego, at the airport, I've got 650 transportation security officers who are literally at the tip of the spear. They really have a difficult job. I'll talk just a bit about that first. When new TSOs come into the organization, I meet with them at their orientation, and I look straight at them and I say, this is a really, really tough job. And the reason it's difficult is because TSA has two strategic goals. One is for world-class security, and one is for world-class customer service. And so think about it. If you were working for a service organization and you looked at an application, and on the application it said work experience, and it said counterterrorism, I bet you'd go, what a great attribute for somebody in customer service. Right. So it's one of the things that makes it so difficult. And we have great people that do great work, but the reality is they have to maintain an edge and a focus and attention to detail sufficient to protect you and to be an effective counterterrorism force. And they still have to do it with compassion and sensitivity and attention to your needs and everybody else's needs at the same time. So it is a very challenging job. I'm proud of our team in San Diego, and we're always trying to do better. So let's look at TSA as an agency. TSA, as I think most of you know, was set up a little over 10 years ago in 2002 with the passage of the Aviation Transportation Security Act. It established the agency at the time. We went from zero to about 50,000 employees in 18 months. That is really something that's never been accomplished except perhaps in a wartime military buildup. General Motors didn't do it. GE didn't do it. Nobody's done it. So for the folks that were around in 2002 and put the agency together, it was quite an accomplishment. We're still at about 50,000 inspectors, officers, leaders, folks across the country responsible for their mission, which is to maintain the free movement of persons and commerce throughout the transportation system. We all know what happened after 9/11. In addition to the tragic loss of life, the country really came to a grinding halt. We're here to make sure that never happens again. The other significant part of what we do is that we actually also protect other modes of transportation, maritime, rail, highway, and pipeline. So we have to take care of all of those things. I mentioned I came from the airline industry. One of my favorite axioms when we look at the actual work that we have to do is that you have to match the experience with the expectation. That's kind of where the essence of customer satisfaction is. And so we're trying to do these things at the same time of setting an expectation and making sure that we meet that expectation actually in the experience. So as TSA has evolved over the years, we have a new administrator, John Pistol, who comes from the FBI. And he recognized right away that the real mission at TSA wasn't to screen passengers. The real mission was a counterterrorism mission. And that's what we set out to accomplish. In order to do that, we really had to move away from the one-size-fits-all approach to screening. While that worked very well initially as we made the transition from pre-9/11 to 9/11, post-9/11 and TSA, the fact is that the threat continues to evolve. There are bad guys out there that for which aviation is a very attractive target. And so we've had to change our tactics. And we're really doing that through a risk-based, intelligence-driven approach to counterterrorism. To kind of set the stage for where the organization is going, I think it's important to kind of look back at what security at the airport was like pre-9/11. You have to remember that before 9/11 and before TSA, there was no cohesive system in place to check passengers' names against terrorist watch lists in advance of flying. We only had limited technologies in place to uncover a wide array of threats to passengers or aircraft. There was no comprehensive federal requirements to screen checked bags or carry-on luggage. We had minimal in-flight security on most flights. And perhaps most important from a coordination standpoint, before 9/11, there was a lack of timely intelligence sharing, both from the federal level to the airports and also back up from the airports to the federal level. So since 9/11, since TSA, we've partnered with industry stakeholders and airline partners to really build a more cohesive structure in what we do. The addition of intelligence gathering and a really effective intelligence gathering has allowed us to really make this transition to a risk-based, intelligence-driven approach to security. In the past 10 years, there's a couple of milestones that are significant. We now match 100% of all passengers flying into, out of, and within the United States against a government watch list through the Secure Flight Program. We screen all air cargo transported on passenger aircraft domestically. We work with our international partners to ensure that high-risk cargo is screened that comes into the United States on cargo and passenger airplanes. And we've improved security throughout the agency with innovative technology that provides advanced baggage screening for explosives. Additionally, since 2005, we've conducted more than 26,000 visible intermodive and preventive and response, or VIPER, operations. We have 25 multimodal VIPER teams working in transportation sectors across the country. Since 2006, we've completed 190 baseline risk assessments for security enhancements in various modes of transit, which basically means we go out to various modes of transportation, whether it's the coaster, Amtrak, whatever, pipelines all over the country, and do a threat assessment and make the enhancements that are necessary to protect those systems. We're seeing a lot of benefits from these changes, which really is the heart of our multi-layered approach to security. We've also added cutting-edge technology. Just so you know, since 2002, we've screened nearly 6 billion passengers through the United States. It's really a tremendous number, given the fact that most passengers have two or three carry-on items and a couple of checked bags. You can multiply that by five if you want to know what we're doing behind the scenes in terms of checked baggage and screening of other items. It is really amazing, frankly, that 10 years after 9/11, throughout the TSA system, we still detect and deter and actually prevent 5 or 6 firearms a day from getting on airplanes. It's hard to believe, isn't it? They're still out there. So let's talk about technology. We've introduced a number of state-of-the-art technologies to enhance our capabilities. AIT is one of them, advanced imaging technology. While there's no perfect technology, AIT gives our officers the best opportunities to detect both metallic and non-metallic threats, including those used similar to the Christmas Day bomber, the underwear bomber. You know, in spite of the seriousness of that, how'd you like to go through life being known as the underwear bomber? Right. So he's safely in prison as the underwear bomber, where he'll remain forever. The manufacturers of this technology, they continue to enhance this equipment, both in terms of capability and strengthening the privacy features of the equipment. We're also able to modify the software as new threats come available for the detection of those threats. It allows us to keep up with a continually changing threat environment. The bad guys are continuously evaluating our technology and our techniques in an effort to beat them, so we have to stay ahead of them at all times. Strengthening privacy, I mentioned that. It's a very, very important piece of what we do. And recently, last year, about this time last year, we introduced a new feature to our millimeter wave advanced imaging technology. It really eliminates the actual image of the person altogether, so the privacy issues associated with that are no longer present in that technology. And instead, what we get is I call it an avatar or a mock-up, or it's a little bit more elegant than a stick figure, but it's basically that, and it identifies the location of the threat that we have to resolve. So as you know, there was a lot of controversy around our AITs when they first rolled out, and we continue to work to try to mitigate that. In addition, it doesn't just come down to technology. We are also trying to improve our procedural standards to be both more efficient, and it's really at the heart of this thing that we're going to talk about now called risk-based security. So one way we're doing that is by putting different practices in place that are based on risk and intelligence. The intelligence that we get, and it allows us to do some things. I mentioned earlier that we're now able to vet and check 100% of all the passengers flying domestically against a watch list. Doing that gets us closer to really being able to assess risk in individual passengers. So we're doing that. Again, we're moving away from the one-size-fits-all model and trying to get closer because the goal really is to apply our resources toward the highest risk threat that we have out there. TSA has already begun to implement risk-based screening across the country. These initiatives enable us to focus resources on those persons who pose the greatest risk, including those on terrorist watch lists, while providing expedited screening to other passengers that we know to be trusted travelers. So in 2011, we implemented a couple of new concepts around this. We introduced a program that allows us to identify pilots and verify their identity and expedite their screening. We've also made adjustments in the screening procedures for children under 12 and for those passengers over 75. Specifically, children under 12 don't have to take their shoes off anymore, which is for any of, for those of us that have had small children, putting those shoes on and off is enough to exhaust you for the day, pretty much ruin your trip. But it is important. We also have procedures now that reduce the likelihood that children are going to need additional screening measures. Also for passengers over 75, they no longer have to take off their shoes. They can wear a light outer garment, headwear. They can also keep on. Most significant to these new processes and procedures really is pre-check. It's getting a lot of press. I hope you've heard of it. We're very excited about it. And PreCheck is really an initiative that focuses on our ability to do pre-screening for individuals on whom we have a lot of information. So we've partnered with our major airline, the major airlines, and also U.S. Customs and Border Protection on this PreCheck initiative. And so what happens is certain frequent travelers from several major airlines are able to apply for this program, provide us with additional information, and actually become members of PreCheck program. Also, through CBP's global entry program, we're also able to, if you're not a frequent traveler, you can also join PreCheck through that process as well. So if you are a frequent traveler, you should contact your airline, whichever that one may be, and ask for information about participating in PreCheck. And certainly, like I said, if you're not, you can go to the website and go to globalentry.gov and apply there and get some more information. Passengers with disabilities can sign up for PreCheck as well, receive the same benefits. And those benefits really are actually pretty significant. You don't have to take off your shoes. You don't have to take the 311 baggie out of your carry-on bag. You don't have to remove your laptop from your bag. You can wear a light outer jacket, and you don't have to take off your belt. So clearly, not having to remove your shoes, belt, items, and those things from your carry-ons, especially for the blind and those with visual impairments, it's a big help going through the checkpoint. So I encourage you to look further into PreCheck. We also have a dedicated lane for PreCheck, which will generally speed things along. You don't have to wait in line. PreCheck lanes also are less likely to have advanced imaging technology, so that tends to speed things up. And for those of you with service animals, that decomplicates things a little bit as you go through the checkpoint. So really, this is a significant shift in our strategy. It allows us, as I said, to focus more on those passengers that pose the highest risk as we continue to identify populations that pose a lesser risk, and also hopefully put in place some things that help speed you through the checkpoint and get on your way. So I mentioned earlier as well, really a big part of my being here today is to talk a little bit about what happens at the security checkpoint and how those procedures affect you. I'm going to go over those again and help clarify what those are, and then we'll certainly have some time at the end for questions. I spoke earlier, you know, customer satisfaction is predicated on having the expectation meet the experience. I know most of you are probably familiar with the screening process, and there are concerns that the procedures aren't always done exactly right every time. With 50,000 officers and even with my 650 in San Diego, we really strive for excellence and consistency. We're going to continue to do that, but I think it's important for us to go over the procedures again and talk a little bit about them and hopefully make it a little bit easier. So, persons with visual disabilities have to be screened like everybody else. You have to undergo screening. But it's really important, and please remember this, anytime you're uncomfortable with the procedures, you can ask for a private screening and get personalized attention through that process. That's always open to you. You ask for it, we're happy to do it. And while the procedures don't change, it generally is a little bit more, you can take your time and get through the things that we need to do. It's out of public view in a private location. Your family or companions can stay with you at all times. If you have a service animal, we're not going to separate you from your service animal. Generally, standard screening process includes x-ray of your accessible property, whatever you have with you, and walk-through metal detector screening. And there may be additional screening depending on what happens in that process, including pat-downs, carry-on inspections, and explosive trace detections. So we have a number of measures that we employ in certain circumstances in order to resolve any concerns that we may have. You may divest your items, such as outer jackets, items from your pockets and shoes during x-ray screening, unless you're over 75 and you don't need to do that anymore, under 12. Your cane or other assistive device must be x-rayed or physically inspected. So a couple things on that. For x-ray, and canes and any, if you have a braille note taker or something like that, they have to undergo x-ray or hand screening by an officer. You should tell the officer, please tell the officer if they need to be returned to you immediately, and we'll make sure that happens. If you have a collapsible cane, We'd like you to, you can collapse it and place it in the container for x-ray. Otherwise, non-collapsible canes can be placed directly on the x-ray belt, and we'll get them back to you. In San Diego, we have plastic canes at the checkpoint. They should be available to you to use if you wish. If it's unavailable for whatever reason in San Diego or at any other airport, there should be somebody there to assist you. Either way, there should be somebody there to assist you, and we want to make sure that happens. And we'll remain with you until we're done with the screening process. If you desire physical inspection of your cane instead of x-ray, you can walk through the walk-through metal detector with your cane, and the officer will inspect it for you afterwards. If for some reason there's any anomalies with your cane, then we will ask to run it through the x-ray. Okay? If you have a service animal, they have to undergo walk-through metal detector screening right along with you. There's a couple ways to do that. You can let them walk ahead of you, or they can walk behind you. You can go through first, and they can come along after. If you walk through with them together, which is perfectly okay, and either one of you alarm, and the service animals generally will because they've got some metal on them in their harness and stuff, then there may be some additional screening required to resolve whatever that alarm was on both yourself and on the animal. We may ask you to assist us in screening the animal, which may involve some pat-downs and some other things. We're going to visually inspect the service animal and certainly pat down the harness and the other things. You don't need to remove anything. We're not going to ask you to remove the harness or anything else from your service animal. That can certainly stay. And I'm sorry. Thank you so much. Do you want me to start over? Okay. Does that mean hurry up? Okay. No, that's fine. So especially with these procedures, if you didn't hear it, I'm happy to go back. We didn't start that long. Okay. All right. So some of our officers may well not be comfortable around animals. If that's the case, they may ask another officer to come and do the inspection of your animal, of your service animal. So that does happen from time to time. If your service animal needs to be relieved for any reason, some airports are actually installing relief areas behind the checkpoint. I don't know that San Diego is intending to do that. But I do know that it's a bit frustrating. If you do have to leave the sterile area to go and relieve your animal, you are entitled to come to the front of the line, okay, so you don't have to stand in line again. And this is a really important point. TSA doesn't actually manage the lines. The airlines manage the lines and everything in front of our ticket document checker. So there may not be a TSA officer out there to assist you. So you can walk right past the line as you need to. We can direct you and get you there to get up to the ticket document checker where we'll let you through and start the screening process right there so you don't have to stand in line. Okay. Important part of the screening process, if you do have a service animal, is that we always ETD your hands, electronic trace detection of your hands, when you come through the checkpoint with a service animal. That just involves a few swipes of your hands with a dry, it's like a little swab, and testing it for explosives. Okay. I know some of this sometimes you say, well, what does this have to do with me? And I just want to reemphasize again that, the bad guys have made it very clear that they're willing to use women, seniors, children, passengers with disabilities, not passengers with disabilities, but bad guys with disabilities, in wheelchairs and other things to beat our system. So we try really hard to be cognizant of the special needs, but there is a very important security element to what we're doing. Okay, and just another note again, different protocols will apply if you're under 12 or over 75, as we talked about, a little bit easier path through the checkpoint for now. So that's something important as well. So in terms of service, many of you may or may not know now, but we started a program early this year called TSA Cares. TSA Cares is a helpline number that you can call. It's designed specifically to assist travelers with special needs and disabilities. They're there to answer your questions about exactly what procedure you can expect when you get to the airport. And in many cases, if you ask, they will arrange, they will forward the information on your arrival and your travel to our local customer service manager, and we'll make sure that things go well when you get to the airport. So we'd like you to call 72 hours ahead of time. And I can give that number to Eugene. The information is all on our website as well. And our website is it 309 compliant? So you can access that. Okay, so we've talked a little bit about TSA's mission, about how our approach to our mission and protecting the free movement of passengers and commerce throughout the country have evolved over time, where they're going in terms of a risk-based, intelligence-driven strategy. And then certainly, most important to you, the procedures and the process that really should be taking place at the airport when you come out to travel, both in San Diego and throughout the airline industry and the country itself. So with that, I can take some questions. Yes, Gene. Let's see. Gene, I think I saw Gene's hand go first.
Thank you.
Whoops. Whoa. Okay. Don't get too close. Leg cramps. Sorry. These seats are really bad on the back. I assume that pretty much procedures are standardized throughout the country, and maybe some variations depending on the needs locally, but Sacramento Airport, I've gone through recently through the new system and body check, and I noticed how it was very sensitive where they actually picked up, and I had totally forgotten, in the crease of my pants pocket, half of a Vicodin pill, and they told me, he says, do you have something in your pocket? And I turned out my pockets and showed that. And so I was just wondering, you know, and they let me have the pill, keep it. But for situations like right now where these leg cramps have herniated discs. The question is, are they that very detailed sensitivity? And if so, why is it necessary for us to relinquish our wallets? That really frightens me personally, and I know that's a strong word, but when I'm going with a SkyCap, sometimes who's daydreaming, and I'm not saying the TSA agents shouldn't be trusted or anything, but I hate being separated from my wallet with my ID and my credit card and money, to have that and keep on asking, can I have my wallet back beside my other belongings? So, and because before, when I used to go through the body search, they did take, you know, hold up the wallet in front of me right there and would check it. But now when the scan, I would think that, wouldn't it pick up anything that would be a question? Thank you. Sorry for rambling.
No, can everybody hear me? Yeah, that's a great question. So a couple things. It's very important to remove everything out of your pockets, even small bits of paper and things like that. They can show up as an anomaly and have to be resolved. I can't really talk too much about the actual sensitivity of the machine, but I think it's great that it picked up your Vicodin pill. So that's a good thing. With regard to your wallet, you are entitled and you can hold your wallet in your hand when you go through the AIT. Just hold it up over your head, and then we'll search it on the other side. So if you ask the question, can I hold my wallet, you can certainly do that. But we will look at it on the other side. If it's really bulky and we can't quite discern what's in it, we may ask to X-ray it. So, but I understand the sensitivity is separating it from you, but you can hold it as you go through the AIT. Yeah, no, it is. You can certainly do that. And I didn't mention the AIT. You can certainly use the AIT. That just the requirement is that you're able to put your hands over your head and hold the pose for about 7 seconds. So if you're comfortable with that, absolutely, that's a great option, especially for folks that have hip replacements and other metallic implants, knee replacements, any of that. One of the challenges, though, is that we cannot screen you with your service animal in the AIT. Okay?
Thank you. I guess I'm compelled to comment, tell a quick story. When you mentioned the 100% screening, I'm a frequent traveler. I was coming back from our West Virginia affiliate a couple of years ago with a friend, and he warned me on the way to the airport. He said, I'm always stopped. I think I'm on a watch list. And in fact, he was. Now, understand, he's totally blind. Some of you will know him. His name is Pat Sheehan. He had no idea why he was always stopped. Several months later, I encountered a professor who is familiar with English and Irish history and current events, and she proceeded to tell me that there is a Patrick Sheehan who is a member of the Ulster Defense Force, which were the Protestant bad guys. And apparently this gentleman named Mr. Sheehan spent some time in the constabulary. And I guess I bring it up because obviously the system is not yet foolproof, but you would think after several years it might get that way. And so I just thought you might wish to comment on the accuracy of the system that we all count on to expedite our travel.
Yeah, so we continue to refine and improve the quality of the information on the watch list. I think we've made some great strides of late. Every once in a while, there is certainly somebody on the list with a similar exact name that matches somebody that perhaps should be on there. And we do have a redress process. So if somebody finds themselves or suspects, having gone through some additional screening measures, that they may be on the watch list, they can get that information off our website and apply to have that looked at.
I shall tell him. Yes, I shall.
Okay, thank you. And I apologize for the additional screening that he may have gone through. So, yes, ma'am in front.
Hello.
Yeah, I'm sorry. He's taking care of that. Okay, thank you.
Okay. The screening process is getting more and more sophisticated, as we all know. I guess one of the great concerns that you guys have is the plastics that are surgically implanted in a human body. I guess, is that still a tremendous threat and a possibility of going through?
Having an explosive device implanted in a human body? Plastic explosives, yeah. Just plastic. So you're not referring to medical implants, but. Okay. So a plastic implant should not alarm the walkthrough metal detector, if that's what your question is. it detects metallic objects. So folks that have a metallic implant of some kind, a knee replacement, a hip replacement that's made of metal, will alarm the walk-through metal detector. Plastic would not have that effect.
Hello? Oh, there it is. That there was an attempt a year or two years ago to surgically implant explosive in a body.
Right. Okay, that's what I thought your question was. I apologize for the confusion. It's true. There has been intelligence out there that indicates that they are trying to do that. You know, I can't really comment on the threat environment at the moment. But certainly there was intelligence. It did make the news media in terms of those efforts to do that. I really don't know where that is at this point.
Okay. My question was about the pre-check process. Is there a charge for that? And if so, is it a one-time fee?
You know, I apologize. I don't know if there's a charge to join PreCheck. I will get an answer for you, though, and let you know, okay? If there is a charge, I don't believe it's very substantial, and there was a process in place for a while where there were companies that were trying to arrange for expedited service through the security checkpoint. And they had an enrollment, a membership program, and fees that continued. To my knowledge, I don't know. I don't think that there's a fee in either case, but I will find out for you.
Thank you for this informative presentation and for TSA's efforts. I wanted to return to the question raised by Gene and to something that you alluded to in your presentation about the difficulties that blind people face in keeping track of their valuable possessions, because unlike other passengers, of course, who can see where their articles are, we can't. And you said it might be possible in some cases with regard, for example, to something like a valuable, expensive Braille device to carry it with you and ask that the agent check it by hand. I've not found in a couple of efforts over the years, it may have changed recently, of course, it's successful in doing that. They've insisted that it be put in the basket. And at the point where you put it in the basket, you're not even in enough proximity to an agent of TSA to ask for a question for an alteration. So what is the exact procedure for my carrying my expensive Braille device with me and handing it to an officer who will then return it to me after inspecting it such that it is never out of the officer's grasp when it's out of my hands?
Well, we do have to X-ray your carry-on luggage.
I'm not disputing that at all.
They have to be subject to X-ray search. There's no way for us to keep it, in your hands per se, but we can have somebody with you to walk through the process and communicate with you on where your items are and make sure that.
Could you be specific? What do I ask to whom and at what point?
You can ask for a private screening, and ask for an officer to stay with you and your belongings while you're screened.
At what point do I ask that question? Because at the time that you're required to put your objects into the basket, you're nowhere in proximity to an officer.
Right. I think if you ask at the point that your IDs are checked, and generally that's done off to the side, in our airport anyway, we bring passengers with disabilities and those that need assistance generally around the main line and have their IDs checked, and that would be the place to do that.
Hello. Okay. It is working. Okay. My question has to do with on the a lot of the newscasts we're seeing increasing instances of TSA agents stealing from people's luggage, stealing from people's bags, stealing money, other things like that. You know, a lot of us tend to carry kind of valuable things like our smartphones and things like that in our bags or whatever, and I guess I'm just wondering how closely are these applicants checked in terms of background checks or whatever? How closely are applicants for TSA screeners being checked? Because it just troubles me that this kind of thing is going on, because there's nothing that you can do about it. You do have to surrender these things, And I guess just kind of trust that, you know, you're going to get your stuff back the way it should be. I know that personally it kind of troubles me. It makes me feel bad about having to surrender these things and give up control of them.
Yeah, I think that's a valid concern. I can tell you that we take these incidents when they occur very, very seriously. I'm sure you've heard in the press that a number of officers in Newark recently were fired. We address those issues. We take the integrity of the workforce very, very seriously for all the reasons that you mentioned. Our officers do get an extensive criminal history records check, as well as a background check, a full federal background check. So they are vetted. Regrettably, when you have 50,000 officers out there, there may be one that there may be a bad apple in the group. It's actually very disturbing to all of us, and certainly to the officers, because it does affect their reputation. It affects the public trust, as you very well articulated here. So we take it very, very seriously. I can tell you that in San Diego, certainly at the checkpoint, we have comprehensive closed-circuit TV. All of our officers know that it's surveilled continuously. And so in the event that something is missing, and we've had passengers misplace things and say, gee, I know it's gone, it's stolen, and we look and we can immediately identify what happened and what occurred. But I think the more important piece is that our officers, we believe the officers have integrity, they want to do the right thing, they know that they have a public trust, and when things don't go that way, we take very, very swift action and take it very seriously. So I do appreciate the concern.
We have to wrap up here pretty soon. So
can you? Okay, thank you. First off, I want to commend TSA for the good work that you are doing. Thank you for making my life safer when I fly. I have two questions for you. One, you're doing some work with the retina imaging scanning. I'm not quite sure what that's called. How does that work if you have an individual who has fake eyes, glass eyes? Prosthetic.
Okay.
Prosthetic eyes. And then my other question is, I'm traveling out of state, and I want to bring some items that are unique to California. One happens to be a salad dressing, and I want to know, if I put it in the underneath bag, are there any limitations as to what I can bring? Thanks.
Okay. Retinal imaging is not, at this point, on the horizon that I'm aware of as a security measure with TSA. There's lots of technology out there that's been talked about, facial recognition and other things like that, but the actual retinal imaging that sometimes appears in various films and is talked about is really not something that I've seen or heard of is going to be part of our technology in the near future. To your other question, the salad dressing and the other things, liquids, they're still limited to what appears to be less than 3.4 ounces. So better to put it in your checked bags. You'd be amazed. People ship wine and all sorts of beverages and bottles and liquids and things in their checked bag. So if you're taking sizable liquids, you can put it in your checked bag and wrap it in bubble pack or something like that, and it should come through just fine.
It's not turned on.
There we go. Thank you. Hi, this is Doug Martin. Question. Sometimes you don't know what is going to be confiscated at the gate. I mean, I understand there's guidelines, but what do I do if I have something that I consider personally very valuable and they tell me you can't take this on the airplane? Do I have any recourse for getting it to my destination or shipping it back home, or is there anything I can do at that point?
Well, if you come through the checkpoint with something that is prohibited, it's on the prohibited item list, and it's still a pretty lengthy list, but it generally boiled down to a weapon, incendiary or explosive device, or something that can be used as a weapon, or in some cases a replica firearm, for instance, then you're going to have to surrender it. For most of those items, unless it's truly a deadly and dangerous weapon at the time, you have an option of either taking it and leaving the checkpoint, in which case, you know, you can put it back in your car or dispose of it or do something with it, give it to whoever brought you to the airport, or we're going to have to confiscate it and keep it. The best practice, frankly, is to, if you have something that's valuable that you want to get to the other destination, put it in your checked baggage, or in some cases you can ship it. But yeah, it's, you know, we just have a prohibited items list, and we can't let that stuff up into the sterile area and onto the aircraft. That's what we do. Okay. We have one more? No? Okay.
Sorry, what's happening? Okay. Yeah, so I just might say in connection with that that one time I have a backpack with a whole bunch of pockets in it, and I forgot to look in one of them, and my Swiss Army knife was in there. And they allowed Bernice to go out to the front counter, and they checked it through for me, so I got it. As soon as I got to the other end, put my Swiss Army knife in a big box and checked it through. So sometimes they can handle that. And I'm really glad to know that there's one more milestone in my life, at least. When I'm 75, I can leave my shoes on. But anyway, we are out of time, and I want to thank Mr. Leonard very much for...
Thank you all very much.
And I'm looking forward to... I'll be flying tomorrow to get home, so we'll be your guests tomorrow. At this point, we're going back to business, sort of, I think. It's time for the Mutt Strutt Report. Is Peter Pardini here?
Yep.
Oh, she is. Okay, are we going to do a door prize, Madam Chair?
Let's do a door prize.
Okay. You might be able to get the TSA guy to draw a door prize. So. I think I fixed it. It was my assistive listening device that was causing the feedback.
It's a macrame plant hanger from Humboldt.
Chapter.
Who's drawing?
Gabe.
Vince Calderon, are you here? Okay, is that... What's that?
It's Paula. Can I make just one quick comment?
Oh, sure.
Ladies and gentlemen, this is Paul Leonard again. If I could just make one more comment that perhaps I didn't state as clearly as I would have liked, and that is we have supervisors at our checkpoints whose job it is to smooth the way and to react to issues as they arise. So... please don't hesitate if it's not going the way that you would like or it's getting complicated. Ask to talk to a supervisor, and I fully expect them to be responsive and assist you, and they will escalate it as they need to in order to make sure that we get things squared away. Okay, that's what we're there for. So please ask for a supervisor.
Thank you very much for that. Paul, the airlines also have what do they call them, dispute resolution officers, I think. So between TSA supervisors and airline dispute resolution officers, you ought to be able to appeal any issues to somebody in some authority. You ready, Peter? Okay, the next item on the program is a report on the Mutstrut that we had in September. And there's probably no one who can do that better than our treasurer, Peter Pardini. Peter.
Thank you very much, Roger. I'd like to begin the report with a financial Mutstrut report. Basically, for the 2012 Mutstrut, as of October 28, 2012, I'm going to go ahead and read the regional information. The Los Angeles region had a budget of $30,250. There had income in the amount of $744. The budgeted expenses were $11,350. The expenses for the Los Angeles region were $425, leaving a difference between expenses and income and expenses in the amount of $319.
That's the one that didn't happen.
It didn't happen. This one did not happen.
Right.
But they still raised money.
Yes, they did. That's great.
Moving on to the Sacramento region, their income budget was $7,500. They raised $6,940. Their expense budget was $3,850. Their actual expenses were $3,263, leaving a difference between income and expenses in the amount of $3,677. And moving on to the San Francisco region. The San Francisco region had a budget, an income budget in the amount of $9,400. The actual income for the San Francisco region was $10,254. The budgeted expense amount was $5,815. The actual expenses were only $3,263. The difference between income and expenses is in the amount of $6,991. We also had people that donated did not designate a region. We received an amount of $275 for undesignated funds received based on the Mutstrut. Let me go ahead and read all the totals. The total budget for the income budget for the Mutstrut was $47,150. The actual income for the Mutstrut, $18,215. The budgeted expenses were $20,995. The actual expenses were, for the two regions, Sacramento and San Francisco, $6,952, leaving a difference of net income less expenses in the amount of $11,263. And at this time, I'd really like to thank all the region participants. This was a very successful event for the California Council of the Blind. And we hope to do better in 2013, this year, in 2013, we're going to have four regions, hopefully. Los Angeles, Sacramento, San Francisco, and hopefully the new region of San Diego. This is provided that all regions get their necessary information in by November 30th, and they're complete, and the board approves each region's information, which will be done at a board meeting in early December. This concludes the financial portion of this report.
Thank you. Thank you, Peter. The remaining afternoon is being set aside for a very serious item that we need to discuss based on a proposed constitutional amendment from the last convention in the spring. And for this business, I'm going to relinquish the chair and give it back to our lovely president, Donna Pomerantz.
Okay, thank you, everyone. And I have Peter Pardini up here as our treasurer, and I also have Gabe Griffith up here in the front as well, who is chairing our Constitution and Bylaws Committee. So, and Roger, if absolutely, Roger, you should definitely stay. Roger has been on the Constitution and Bylaws Committee and has worked on it at times when our chair has not been able to be here due to illness and obligations. So the item on the table up for discussion is the constitutional amendments that were proposed in the spring. And I would like to have Gabe get a microphone. Do you need Rogers or Ed has a wireless for you.
Ed has one. Okay. So
and people are already yawning, and we're just starting. Must be Kevin. Okay. So I'm going to give it over to Gabe so that he can, and Roger, you can help me out with the parliamentary stuff because I will ask. We'll have Gabe do a reading. And Roger, my question is, there are two sections, correct, Gabe?
There are two sections that are being amended or that are being specified here in this proposed amendment, but I'm going to read them as one proposed amendment.
It was our feeling, Gabe and I talked about this, and it seems to me that we really have one amendment. The intent is to do one thing, and it's just there are two different pieces of language. And so I would propose that we do it all in one swell foop, as they say. So this is basically what we're doing in the Constitution is coming back to the Constitution Committee report and rereading an amendment that we read at the last convention, which will then allow us to discuss it and vote on it.
No, it's wired. Now, if while they're doing the mic dance and trading mics, I would encourage everybody, hopefully you all have your badges with the orange dot, okay, so that you can receive a ballot. If and when the time comes that may be needed. Because with our group, anything is possible.
All right, Donna, I've got a mic with a stand, okay, so that I don't have to try to do three things with two hands, so I'm ready to read whenever you're ready.
Perfect. So if we could have if folks could pay attention to Gabe so that we won't have any. Okay, go ahead, Gabe.
Okay, hello, everybody. This is my first opportunity to address you since Donna has asked me to chair this committee, so thank you, Donna, for having the confidence in me for this, and thank you, everybody. Hopefully, you can do a good job. And thank you, Roger, for some advice yesterday when we were going over this. What we have here is an amendment that the first reading was done at the spring convention. So this will be the second reading, which will then be able to be opened up for a motion and discussion if that is necessary. It is, as we said, one amendment, but there's going to be three parts that I'll be saying to this. So part one is section 5.1 of Article 1 of the Constitution is amended by striking semi-annually and inserting annually. And just to the way I'll be reading this is I'll say what the amendment would do. I'll read the current language, and then I'll read what the new language would be. So section 5.1 currently reads, section 5.1, there shall be a regularly scheduled meeting of the California Council of the Blind semi-annually, the time and place to be fixed in advance by the president or the convention. It would read, section 5.1, there shall be a regularly scheduled meeting of the California Council of the Blind annually, the time and place to be fixed in advance by the president or the convention. Okay, and now part two is the second and third sentences of section 10.4 of Article 10 of the Constitution are both amended by striking out, quote, fall convention of, end quote, and inserting, quote, convention in, end quote. Section 10.4 currently reads, and I'm just going to read the pertinent part of it, all officers and directors shall be elected for two-year terms, subject, however, to the provisions set forth in this article. The president, first vice president, treasurer, and four directors shall be elected at the fall convention of each even-numbered year. The second vice president, the secretary, and five directors shall be elected at the fall convention of each odd-numbered year. That section would read, and again, I'm just going to read the pertinent part of it, all officers and directors shall be elected for two-year terms, subject, however, to the provisions set forth in this article. The president, first vice president, treasurer, and four directors shall be elected at the convention in each even-numbered year. The second vice president, the secretary, and five directors shall be elected at the convention in each odd-numbered year. And the third part of this proposed amendment is that these changes would not take effect until the 2014 year. Madam President, that concludes the second reading of this proposed constitutional amendment. And the Constitutional Amendment and Bylaws Committee, since it was just Roger,
doesn't know I'm going to do this, but Madam President, I move adoption of this constitutional amendment.
Second. Okay, we have several seconds.
No, only several seconds.
Okay, so there's been a motion and a second.
Point of order.
And
And
what I requested is that whoever asks for the floor must give me their name so that I may recognize you by name, please.
Tom Carnes.
Tom Carnes.
I didn't get a dot.
And I'm hearing that from Bernice that Tom Carnes is a life member of CCCLV. Okay.
So,
yes, you're yes. And so because we have that, and Roger and Gabe, let me know if I'm out of order, but I feel confident that because we have that direct verification from the president of one of the affiliates as well that Tom is a member of, I'm willing to accept that.
We'll get a dot when Mary Lou comes back in the room.
Okay.
Thank you.
And I would say that it really is important, especially when we get in this discussion, and folks are going to chuckle because, you know, normally I'm nicknamed as the Queen of Chaos at times. But I prefer...
I thought that was your twin.
That's my twin. I prefer lots of order here so that everyone can be heard in the proper order. So again, please state your name when you call for the floor. Okay. So we have a motion. We have a second. Any discussion?
Madam President, this is Frank Welty.
Frank Welty?
I think many of you realize my position on this this amendment. I am in favor of it to the extent that I had an article published in a recent issue of the Blind Californian, which was called "One Convention, 45,000 Reasons in Favor."
And in the interest of timing, folks.
In the interest of time, I'm going to limit myself to seven. First of all, this amendment will provide significant savings to the organization. We currently are running a continuous structural deficit in which our annual fundraising does not reach our annual operating expenses. This needs to be resolved. We've already done as much cutting in other areas as we possibly can. We've reduced our staff to one staff member. We have eliminated support for sending members to the ACB Washington National Washington Legislative Seminar. And we have eliminated the position of governmental affairs director. Clearly, we need to find other opportunities for cuts. The most significant available, what I would consider a redundancy in our current budget is our second convention. Therefore, we need to eliminate that in order to make a significant dent in our structural budget deficit. Second, free up staff time. Many of you see how hard Ed Branch works here at the convention. That is only the tip of the iceberg. I can speak as one who observed Ed's hard work for 2 years when I was a staff member of this organization. And the convention takes the working for the conventions and preparations takes a considerable amount of Ed's time throughout the year. Reducing from two conventions to one convention will free up a lot of his time for other very important responsibilities for CCB.
30 seconds.
Third, the reducing to two convention from one, two conventions to one convention will be much more affordable for many members who cannot currently attend conventions. Fourth, we will eliminate a lot of duplicate meetings associated with two conventions instead of having one meeting for one convention. Fifth, the reducing from two conventions to one convention will not harm the organization cohesion because we have many alternative for communications that we did not have many years ago, such as email, phone conferencing, and so forth.
Time.
Thank you.
Bernice Kandarian, do you wish to speak against? Okay. Yes.
On Thursday evening at the board meeting, I asked a question about the fact that it's the figure that's been touted is that this convention is costing $25,000. However, at the last convention in the spring, I listened very carefully to Peter's treasurer's report, which on the one side said that it was $45,000 for the two conventions. I do not remember what the amount was on the income side for fees charged of members who attend conventions. And I wanted to know that information. And the second part is that since certain things have been eliminated, like the free lunches and whatever, has that reduction been reflected in the $25,000 figure? What I'm concerned about is that we don't have the accurate information to base our decisions on.
Well, as far as Peter's pulling up specific numbers, and I've stopped the time on the 20 minutes component because she's speaking for a point of information, and we're not doing official for and against at this point. I'm not sure about the free lunches component because those were actually supposed to be lunches that went to our volunteers. And what I would like is if we could get Jeff. That's okay. Ed's going to go back with you to Mike because Jeff was president when the lunches began.
I'm going to admit my own bias so that, you know, just to be clear, as one of the ones who did propose this initially, so I will admit to being biased. But
speak to the.
But yes, I am. I'm just saying that. But speaking to your question, it was the figures that I was able to produce during a number of years. We averaged between $10,000 and $15,000 per convention in terms of the negative, the negative figure was $10,000 to $15,000 per convention that we lost per convention.
Wow.
The some years were better than others. The lunches might have cost at the outside $800 or $900. Hmm. So it was a minor, factor.
Okay. Let me go ahead and... Peter is looking for it. Gene did say that this is related. I think someone had Peter doing maybe something else before because I knew we were going to... He's juggling documents. So Gene, Gabe has a mic. If Gabe can share that with you, if you can go to Gabe.
Oh, I'm right here, Jane.
Arf.
Here you go. If you.
No. This is related to, again, the lunches. I do know that at least for the last maybe year and possibly 2 years of Jeff's administration, that it was the cost of the lunches were incurred by the telephone pioneers who donated
and there were some other sources. We may have supplemented, but it was primarily in the recent times it was actually donated, and then it came to an end when, for instance, the Sacramento chapter could no longer afford to donate because of fundraising issues they were having. And I know that was, bless you, that the San Diego area telephone pioneers could not generate the money at the La Jolla convention. So, and that's just pointing out the fact that in recent times that has been donated. Right. Thank you.
Yeah, they've had their struggles, and it got bigger and bigger, and it was just difficult for them to manage. And I think Peter has his figures. Yes. Do you have a mic, or do you want me to give you? Yeah, you do, I think.
Okay, yeah. Am I on?
Yes, you're on.
Okay, for the spring 2012 convention, we had income in the amount of $50,497 and convention expenses in the amount of $24,559, leaving a difference of expenses were greater than income in the amount of $9,287. For this fall this current convention, with based on pre-registration numbers only, we had income in the amount of $10,538. Expenses, these are just expenses that were incurred prior to when we left for the convention, $12,152. Basically, based on our food and beverage minimum in the amount of $15,000 plus some other related expenses, I expect that we're going to spend an additional $20,000. So basically, it would be for the fall convention, we probably have income in the amount of $14,000, and our expenses would be around $32,000.
Okay.
Okay, hold on.
And Peter was asking for 2011. While he's finding that, what I will share with you is I had a bit of a shock because I asked Peter to do a lot of number crunching for me the weekend before we came so that we could get figures as close to what was relevant. A figure of $45,000 was published in the Blind Californian of the amount of what it cost for two conventions. After Peter did his number crunching, it was actually more. So Peter, go ahead.
I have the
numbers.
Expense number. $58,543. This includes basic portion of it, of our staff support salary, plus the gas and vehicle insurance, a proportion for gas and vehicle insurance, a proportion of board of directors' expenses and insurance, in addition to the normal convention expenses, which include audiovisual, hotel bills, and all printing costs for announcements and the program.
So, Peter, what conventions did that cover?
That covered the two conventions in 2011.
Okay, and how much was the income?
Okay, hold on.
The income figure was $31,000 for the two conventions.
Now, Peter, what is that income figure based on?
Based on both all the money that we receive from registrations, money, ticket sales, and if we've received any
donations
or sponsorships for the convention.
I guess the question that I would have, because people have asked me, is do people specifically donate toward the convention, or do they donate at the convention for CCB work, scholarship, whatever, general fund?
That income is not included in convention.
Good.
This would be basically, it would be if we received any sponsorship monies for the CCB convention. It does not include money that received the donations for the scholarship fund or chapter donations for the general fund.
Good.
That we receive at the convention.
Thank you.
This is strictly related to convention income.
Okay. And Bernice, did you have one more question for your point of information?
No, I think
that's it.
That is
okay.
One
more comment.
There. Okay. It's fuzzy.
That's okay.
What I'm concerned about is that those were not the figures that were in the report that was given at the spring convention, and I guess I'd like to see us do a better job of getting more accurate figures.
Yeah, and I appreciate that, which is why I, Peter, can we turn off all cell phones, please? Thank you. That's why Peter and I work together on coming up with different things that need to be included. It's a work in progress. We're further refining the things so that the reports can be more detailed. So I appreciate what you've stated. Okay.
Point of information.
And who's that, please?
Doug Martin.
Doug. Ed's coming with the microphone.
Hello, Doug Martin, San Diego. I have a point of information request with respect to the second of the three portions of the amendment, where it says, for example, the president and other various officers will be elected in the even-numbered years and so forth. Is there or does there need to be any reference to where those even-numbered conventions would be held? For example, it's reasonably obvious to me that if that's the way the amendment is going to put forth, that 2014 would have to be, let's just say, Southern California, 2016 would have to be in Northern California, thus a president can be elected once in each region. That would pretty much require you to have two consecutive conventions in Southern and then two consecutive conventions in Northern. How can that be resolved?
Okay. Can we have silence in the audience? Thank you. On several calls, these were some of the issues that were discussed. We had two calls talking about these things, and what we proposed to do, and Gabe and Roger, and Roger was on one of those calls, please chime in as well. What we proposed to do, unless the membership dictates otherwise, what we proposed to do is have let me give it over to Gabe to talk about how they see some of the steps happening. But we will have membership-wide conference calls as well to discuss some of these specificities. But what I will say is if this were to take effect, we would be starting it in 2014, and we already have a signed contract in Sacramento for the spring convention at the Arden West in Sacramento. So it would start there.
That wasn't my question.
I know. I'm just giving information to folks so they'll know when it starts. Gabe, go ahead. Take it over.
Okay. And Roger, feel free to chime in here if you have anything too. I don't know if I'm prepared at this time to specifically address your comment about where the elections are held as far as electing presidents or officers or board members in specific regions. What I can say in regards to that is that, yes, there are going to be other ramifications like that that are going to have to be taken into effect. As Donna said, this will not be taking effect until 2014. If this passes today, what I will say that we will have the committee do is the committee will definitely be working on first going through the convention or the constitution and bylaws and identifying issues such as this one that will be affected. We're not going to be able to have
developing, implementing, and reconciling of amendments.
Yeah, we're not going to be able to have things like a nominating committee in the spring and a elections in the fall. What we will do, though, is we will go through and figure out these reconciliations, and we will bring a report on those issues back to this convention in spring of 2013.
Well, how I put on this amendment.
I guess what I might say to answer your question is all of our elections are currently in the fall, so which means all of our elections are always in Southern California. So in a way, to me, this election or this amendment would not really affect that. It would just mean that half of the board is elected in the north and half is elected in the south. If we continue to alternate north and south.
Are you seeking information or are you wanting to?
I want to see if I can help Doug out, and I have a.
Okay.
Doug, this will be my 40th year in this organization, so I've seen a lot of elections, and. I don't think, or at least I can't recall, the last time for an election as important as president that the locale of the convention affected positively or negatively the outcome of an election. Now, I hear your concern, but I really don't believe that where the convention occurs affects at least the officer positions. You might make a case for a director position, but I don't believe that for an officer position that's really a factor. The question I had for Roger and for Gabe, the two proposed changes for Article 10 refer to convention rather than conference and convention, and I thought we had made that change last year.
We did.
Madam President, may I respond to that?
Yes.
I believe, Mitch, when it was voted to move to saying conference and convention, part of that was that it may just be referred to as conference or convention. Sorry. Roger just pointed out I said the wrong word. It was stated that it may be referred to as convention. So I don't believe that substantially affects this.
Very good. Thank you.
David Hanlon, do you have a question for information? Okay.
What about the nominating committee to present a slate of officers? Are we going to have that kind of situation?
Yes, those are some of the logistics as well that were discussed. And what would some of the things that have been discussed were selecting a slate of officers at the beginning of the convention and holding elections at the end of convention, the same convention. And that's been the majority of what's been recommended to do. There was, in the interest of you know, bringing everyone's points forward, there was someone who also said, well, you can, you know, do your slate at one convention and then the following year elect from that slate. So someone else also mentioned that too. And we're not saying yes or no to any of them at this point. I'm just telling you what came out on the calls and what members have mentioned to me. Those are the two things. And who is that that seeks a floor? Cindy Aguilar, can you? Okay, Cindy Aguilar from Sacramento chapter, ACB Capital Chapter.
Oh, I thank you.
I know.
What I have a question in is, I mean, if this passes for one conference per year, I really think we need to have something written in our stone contract saying, Constitution, that this conference needs to be rotated maybe throughout the state, not always in the same region, maybe southern, central, northern, eastern, maybe have one in San Francisco, so that we can educate and voice our opinion throughout the entire state of California, because we are a huge state with a lot of information. There's a lot of visually impaired black people that can't make it to Southern California or can't make it to Northern California, but they can make it when it's in the region.
Okay.
Is that a possibility?
Thank you, Cindy. That was one of the things that was discussed as well. Would we be able to rotate the conference and convention, you know, one in the north, one in central, one in south, and going back to the north, and, you know, every 3 years kind of a thing, switching different parts of the state? That was one of the things mentioned. Another thing that was mentioned was, because we are a grassroots consumer advocacy organization, that we should always have the conference and convention at the Capitol in Sacramento, so that everyone attends a Capitol Day the day before the conference and convention officially starts, because more people would be able to afford to do that in connection with convention. So those are the two things that came out of the two calls and members who have spoken to me directly about things. And again, we're not doing any yes or no's on that. All of that is up for discussion, and assuming this passes, and we will be having calls as well to continue informing you. And as Gabe said, there will be a report at the spring convention of progress. So nothing will be done unless you know about it, I assure that. And who asked for the floor? Okay, Eric Calhoun first. And then there was a gentleman to my left.
Madam President, I just want to say what some of the people have been talking to me about. I got a message from someone who really had some problems, and I'll be talking to Eugene Lozano about this convention, because I have some very major problems with this convention.
Okay, hold
but,
on.
But,
wait.
But
focus
I wanna,
on the question.
I want to concern myself with this item that's on the agenda now.
Yes.
Okay. I think there's some of the people have expressed the need to have this at a location where everybody can go and where everybody can register and not have numbers fall off. And that was one of the major, major problems that I was talking to someone in the Alameda area, because she told me specifically that she was not going to go to the convention as long as certain things were not in place. And I will leave this person unnamed because some of you in Alameda know who she is.
Can you get to the point?
My point is, if you have to have one convention a year, exactly when are you going to have it? That's the question, because I think that's the most important thing, so that people can plan and people can get their money's worth.
And I'd like to have, please, thank you. Some of what came out on the call is that people gave reasons for favoring the spring and some positives about having it in the spring. One connected to Capitol Day in the legislature, and people did give reasons for wanting to have it in the fall as well, and some positives with that. So, again, we will meet and we will discuss all of these issues. We will be reporting again some of the issues that, you know, have been discussed, and you will get a report on that in the spring. But both have expressed, you know, there have been pros and cons for doing it in spring and in fall. So that decision has not been made officially yet. There was someone who said the possibility of having it, and I'm just giving an example, having it in the spring of 2014, having it in the fall of 2015, having it in the spring of 2016. So that was also something that someone mentioned. Again, I'm not saying we're doing it. I'm not saying we're not. I'm just letting you know all that was mentioned. Thank you. There was actually a gentleman with a very soft-spoken voice far to my left who called for the floor first. Who is it, please? Larry Friedman.
Hello, everyone.
Hi, Larry.
I think the evidence is pretty straightforward.
Well, wait. Hold on. Is this going back to open up the debate?
It's in favor, yes.
Okay, so hold on 1 second. Are there any questions for information, or are we ready to go back to the debate and have someone speak against the amendment? You have a question. Okay. Larry, hold that thought. Pam Pology?
I just have a question that could be relevant to whether we have one or two conventions, and maybe you can straighten me out here, please. Regarding the meals, does it save any money at all if we were to reduce the meals, say, to having box lunches or sandwich lunches instead of the large meals that we've been having? Or is it just
Can we please not have any yelling from the audience or this table? Thank you. Go ahead, Pam. Continue.
Thank you, Donna. And you guys, forgive me if I'm asking something that you seem to feel obvious, but it's not to me.
No,
so
every question
is
good.
I'm just trying to learn here. In other words, if we have small lunches or maybe even lighter breakfast, would that be cost effective, or is it a flat rate that they give for meals and it's to our advantage that they are kind enough to give us the large meals that they do? I'm just wondering. Thank you.
Basically, in accordance with our contract, we are limited to a certain amount. Well, we have to use a certain amount in total for food and beverage minimum. We have found that trying to do boxed lunches and things like that cost the same amount of money. We've done direct comparisons and stuff. So it is pretty much still the same amount of money.
Thank you.
You're welcome. And Warren was calling for opening back up the debate. I'd like to ask one more time if there are any other questions, and then I'd like to entertain someone speaking against the amendment. Do you, who seeks the floor? Evelyn Drury, are you? Well, wait. Are you asking a question for information, or are you ready to speak in opposition of the amendment?
I do have a question.
Okay. And go ahead, and if you can stand so Ed can.
I have it now. Okay, I have a question that's connected to a concern, and I'll make it very, very brief. I think we can, many of us understand the need to go to one convention a year, but I feel uncomfortable voting either for or against that until I can get a little bit of assurance, not when the conferences are going to be, but are we going to be able to have one in the south and one in the north and rotate? Because if we can't, then I don't feel that I would be able to vote for it. And the only reason I bring this to your attention is because I feel a lot of other people have the same concern.
Madam President, can
okay,
I this is Gabe,
so
can I respond
what,
to that?
What I would say is that decision will be voted on by the membership at convention.
We don't have any rule
we
like that now.
We it's and actually custom. Roger, go ahead.
It's just custom. It's not a rule even now.
Yeah. So it's
it
not
says the place of the location of the convention will be determined by the, what does it say, by the president or the convention?
By the president or convention.
By
is
the
how
president
it reads.
Or, yeah.
And Madam President?
Yes, Gabe.
Can I add another comment?
Yes.
Gene and I were over here talking. I know I've already said that the Constitution and Bylaws Committee will be looking at this, but Gene has also pointed out that.
Can we please have quiet?
What we'll probably end up doing is having at least a couple of discussions between both the Constitution Bylaws and the Convention Committee, so that because there are going to be several of these issues that need to be brought forth and discussed. So we will make the report in the spring as comprehensive as possible about how this is going to work. But Roger's right, there is no rule.
No, there isn't. But that decision would be voted on by the membership, and it would be my hope in hearing this discussion. It's made me also realize that I hope that the Convention Committee and the Constitution and Bylaws Committee, through their meetings, will come forward with some recommendations so that we can have some of these votes, again, if this amendment were to pass, would start having some of these votes in spring 2013, because currently I am not able to sign any contracts, it would not be wise, until this decision has been made. But be assured that you will have a vote on that as far as location and rotating goes. So, any other questions, or shall we open up debate? 'Twan, do you have a question or debate? Okay. Now, we're going to take this last question because folks need to get into committee, and then we will start up the debate. 'Twan.
Good afternoon, everyone. I'm going to add a question, mainly a technical question. Did you know
can we
or have
quiet,
information?
Because I can't hear Twan. Go ahead.
Okay. I'm like to add a technical question. Did you or anyone in this room have information regarding the potential of membership on the geographical location? In other words, I'd like to know if the total membership is spread out throughout the state, or is it concentrated more in the north or in the south? Thank you.
Okay. The geographic location of our membership. It really is, if you divide, Artis, you're a membership chair, and Ed sees the database, he probably dreams about it.
Too much.
But if you split the state in half, it really is, what did Jeff say? I thought I heard Jeff. It was somebody else with a deep voice. Because I thought you were giving me... He said so. Do we need to have security escort the immediate past president out of the room? Because you guys know I'll do it.
He said he moved the previous question.
He moved.
Which means it's a motion that has to be...
Call for the question. All those... All those in favor of supporting the amendment to move to one convention a year, please. I'm sorry?
Do we not get ballots?
No.
Not yet. We try a voice vote first. We're voting. Okay. Are we vote? Okay, folks, Roger reminds me that we need to vote to end debate, and we have a motion and a second to end debate. All those in favor?
Aye.
Opposed?
Nope.
Abstentions? Okay, motion carries. We end debate. Now we move for the question. All those in favor of supporting the amendments proposed by the Constitution and Bylaws Committee to move to one convention per year, please signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Opposed?
No.
Abstentions? Motion carries. Okay. What I want to say very briefly is this is a very difficult decision. I think that if we had someone that, if all of a sudden we got $2, $3, or $4 million, we would all want to stick with two conventions a year. Roger says what? Roger says, not me, man. Okay. But what I would like to say is we are the CCB family. And whether we agree, whether we disagree, whether we're in the majority, the minority, the issue is we are still a family. And it's going to take each and every one of us to continue to make it work. And this was not a decision that was reached lightly. I'm sure it hurts all of our hearts, but it's what we must do. And I want to thank each and every one of you for being, expressing your opinions. I hope I gave you the opportunity to contact me, and I thank you. And we'll get a door prize, but if you pull Pam Metz's name, put it back in the bucket. Bernice seeks the floor. If we can get a microphone over to Bernice.
It was my understanding that this amendment was put forth by Jeff Tom, and I just want to set the record straight that it didn't come. It has to pass through the Constitution Bylaws Committee, but it wasn't initiated by them.
The Constitution and Bylaws Committee took a no position.
That's correct.
And so, well, what I will say is a group of people submitted this amendment led by, if you wish, Jeff Tom. But frankly, it was a group of several people that did a lot of the writing and such. And Jeff did assist. No, if I said that, I did not mean to say that. What I said is, brought forth is what I said, meaning they read it. So, you know, they did the reading, but you're correct. It did not come from the Constitution.
Amendments are always brought forth by the Constitution.
Yes, it was brought forth, okay. So... do we have a door prize? Okay. Okay.
Or if you want to go ahead and make it.
Okay. Door prize. Wind chime from San Bernardino chapter. Oh, let's have Roger pick that one. A wind chime. Teddy Joy Remhild, are you in the room? Yay! All right. Before we adjourn, I was asked to make an announcement on behalf of our treasurer. Peter says that he does still have some banquet tickets. If folks wish to come to purchase a banquet ticket, come see Peter Pardini. And the other announcement I have is that we do still have some sweepstakes tickets. So if folks are interested, you can definitely see one of us. Hope to see you all at the banquet. Definitely at the Attitude Adjustment Hour. Thank you very much. We are adjourned.